Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the basement of the North Carolina General Assembly, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast, a relatively anticlimactic crossover week here at the legislature. Still plenty of legislation to discuss. More 2020 movement and road tripping. I'm Jeff Tiberi, your guest today, Lauren Horsch, State House reporter for the NC Insider and the News and Observer. Lauren, welcome back to the podcast.
Glad to be here, Jeff, during a not busy week for once.
Right. You have come on the podcast several times at what have been like breakneck weeks where we just like you need 45 minutes and about three cocktails to decompress by the time everybody goes home. This was not that.
No.
Crossover week historically has been a cluster, you know what, but that it was not that this week. What was the most important or most significant bill that moved this week?
Were there any? In the House, I think we had a lot of debate on bills that we weren't expecting there to be debate on. I mean, arguably, even though this week was crossover week and today is crossover deadline, last week felt more like crossover dealing with the mm-hmm. House budget and the ramp up to crossover because we had the House get out on Tuesday and the Senate left yesterday. So it's pretty anticlimactic. I mean, one of the big ones in the Senate yesterday was obviously the opportunity scholarships mm-hmm. debate, which I think we'll talk about later. But there's so much, but I don't know how much of it will be of consequence because you never know what the Senate's going to take up or what the House is going to take up.
Right.
And at this point, I think the focus is really on getting the budget out. So in the next 2, 3, 4 weeks, we're going to see the Senate really slow down a little bit and focus on the budget until we get that out.
We occasionally use the euphemism around here of like, oh, look at the shiny object and the effort by leadership or some lawmakers to get us to look over here at this, you know, this little spinner. It almost felt like, you know, like secondhand earrings or something, silver earrings. Like the objects weren't that shiny this week. There was relatively little controversy.
No, it's like I'm looking at a 25-cent ring that someone like right. got from a machine.
I like it. Yes, that's what I was going for. I mean, just for some context, on Tuesday there were 30 bills that came out of the House. Of those 30, the narrowest vote was a margin of by like 31 or 32, which is to say everything had bipartisan mm-hmm. support and not like one or two Democratic votes, significant bipartisan
support. And that's what, you know, leaders have always said. I think when I first came here, I asked about the issue of bipartisanship because it was right after Trump got elected. So we were like, oh, is there an opportunity for the State House to be bipartisan? And, you know, I think I had both Darren Jackson and Representative Sarah Stevens, who's the Speaker pro tem. They both told me, well, a lot of the bills are largely bipartisan, passed on like an 80 to 90% bipartisan level.
Right. So the quieter nature, one other theory I'm just going to put out there, and we can dissect it a little bit more if you want, is I think that in recent cycles, crossover has been more so a vehicle where lawmakers can push things through quickly with limited debate, limited transparency. And they knew at the time, whatever it was that went through, even if it was going to get vetoed, they had the votes to override it. And that dynamic, the lack of veto-proof majorities, I think was clearly on display again this week.
And I agree with that assessment because, I mean, as we're seeing right now with the Born Alive abortion survivors bill, mm-hmm. we don't know if that's going to get the full veto override. It's obviously been overridden in the Senate, but it's been sitting kind of, you know, just waiting, laying in wait in the House because it's going to take a little bit, you know, a bigger margin to
right.
get that overridden. But I mean, it's really, you kind of have to pick and choose your battles at this mm-hmm. point since you don't have the supermajority to override whatever Cooper vetoes.
When you've got the supermajorities, it feels like you have to do arithmetic. And when you don't have the supermajorities, it's much more calculus.
Mm-hmm.
It's more complicated, obviously, to get
I wouldn't know math. My college math class was called The Spirit of Mathematics. So you were asking the wrong gal on that.
I can do multiplication. That's about it. And I can't spell, so I'm relatively useless. A bunch of bills this week, and I want to attempt to touch on a few and move through relatively quickly because, as we've obviously noted here, there wasn't anything of major impact, of major controversy. We'll start yesterday with opportunity scholarships. This is a measure that moved in the Senate. Ultimately, it passed after 40, 45 minutes of debate.
It was significant for the lack of, just the lack of debate on other bills.
Opportunity scholarships came up a few years ago, introduced by Republicans, and this is these are effectively scholarships, public money or tax dollars that students can use. Initially, it was low-income students to attend private school.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people call them private school vouchers.
Private school vouchers, right. It was a party line vote, with the exception of Ben Clark from Hope County, who was a bill sponsor on this. Take us through, just briefly, some of the rhetoric on both sides of this debate.
Well, I mean, first of all, we really got to talk about the money here. So the Opportunity right. Scholarship yeah. Fund right now has about $12 million on hand. And if, the budgets move forward as they're supposed to, they're going to get an additional $10 million every year through 2026. That's a lot of cash. Like, that's cash we can only dream of. But Cooper, in his proposed budget that he rolled out earlier this year, he cut all of that. So right. It's all phased out. And so essentially the Senate, what they did yesterday was vote on modifying the program to expand the income eligibility, because I forget what it is currently, but if this bill becomes law, the new income eligibility will be $71,456 for a family of four.
Right. And that's well above
the median of, which is like $50,000, I think. So
let me pause real quick and just build on what you're saying. Yes, the new cap for these opportunity scholarships would be roughly $71,500 for annual household income, up from $63,000 and change mm-hmm. right now. And just a little more math: median household income in the state, if I'm not looking at it, if I'm remembering correctly, is $50,000. So 71 compared to 50, it's about 140% of that median household income. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the criticisms we heard from Democrats yesterday.
Natasha Marcus is a senator from Mecklenburg County. One of her big arguments was this program was started to help low-income families get into private schools. Well, a lot of people would argue $71,000 ain't low income.
It's not low income. It's not. I don't perceive that as wealthy. And there might be folks who disagree with me on that, but it's not low income.
No, it's not low income by any means. I think if you ask anyone, right. most people would probably describe that as middle class.
Sure.
I think in this day and age. So it also eliminated the limit on how many kindergartners and first graders that could be served by this. And so Republicans have really been saying, this, gives us a better opportunity to serve more families and get more kids into private schools for those districts that might be low performing or underperforming. But Democrats are really hitting home that, this can, in some cases, lead to segregation. And you'll see, white families leaving the poorer districts, et cetera. But it's also it's not living up to its intended goals now.
One of the other points of debate we heard yesterday was that there is still money in the coffers. Republicans say this is a popular program. The folks who are in it love it. And the Democrats note that there's still some unused, untapped money.
Right now, there's still $12 million there. And I don't think we've ever had an instance since this program has been started where it ran out of money. So there might be a lot of interest, but it's not enough interest to get low every year.
I think on the education front, school choice has been the pillar, if not one of the biggest, most prominent pillars of Republican leadership over the last 8 years. Do we have any sense of the appetite for this in the House at this point?
Oh, I have no idea. Okay. I personally haven't looked into this. I don't cover a ton of education issues, but there might be. I know it's being a big pillar of the Republican platform right. at this point. So you might see it move. It might be a bargaining chip for something else down the road.
Right. And on in within crossover weeks, there is so much that moves. And candidly, I guess shining the light on my ignorance a little bit, there are times you look at a bill, or there are times I look at a bill and I go, oh, that's interesting, or that's clearly not going to do well in the other chamber. And you wonder, does the Senate really want that? Does the House really want this? Or is it, to your point, is it just a bargaining chip?
There's so much backdoor dealing that even right. I don't see as someone who's quote unquote the insider. But you just you can see the wheelings and dealings during crossover when you can see, say, like Senator Bill Raybon, who's the rules chairman in the Senate, come over to the House and, you know, have a quick gaggle with, you know, the Speaker Moore and David Lewis, and then just kind of go away. And you hear someone say, no, we're not doing that, or yes, we will do that. It's there's a lot of dealings that most people don't see.
On Twitter at Lauren Horsch, H-O-R-S-C-H. I literally was about to say a Minnesotan and a bulldog, and then you had to say gaggle. So now I'm going to pick on you a little bit. But I've got here a Minnesota and a bulldog. You went to Drake.
Yeah, Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa.
Are you a Seahawk?
I would say I'm an honorary Seahawk. I have been known to dance with Sammy Seahawk, the mascot at UNC Wilmington at basketball games, but did not attend UNCW.
On the floor or in the aisles?
In the stands.
In the stands. That's what I meant, like yeah. the aisles of the stands. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, a brief interjection here. Back to some more interesting and policy things. There was a lot of debate on the House side this week, a hands-free bill. This pertains, well, initially it felt like it pertained to smartphones and holding technological devices. But then this bill went through the committee process and
got eviscerated.
Eviscerated. Tell us more.
So I was in one of the original committee meetings with this hands-free bill. And like Jeff said, it was really started as kind of a bill to deal with, you know, talking on your phone, texting on your phone. And, you know, right now a lot of cars have these fancy capabilities where you can hook your phone up to Bluetooth and just accept a call from your car console. But some people don't have the ability to buy a fancy car like that. And so there were a lot of questions about personal liberties. You know, are we going to start going into people's cars and, you know, seeing when their last text messages were sent, when their last, you know, phone calls were taking place? And, you know, can you prove that they were actually on their phone? And, you know, the bill ultimately, you know, made its way through the committee process decently, but it had to come back and have major revisions and essentially became a distracted driving bill. And as a lot of House members noted on the floor, we already have distracted driving laws. And
distracted driving just
is broad.
Right.
It's, you know, it can be texting, it can be calling. As we noted during the, you know, the bill process, eating a biscuit.
Eating. Makeup like, going on.
Yeah. Pro tip, don't put on mascara when you're driving. Please don't.
All right. I'll do it only in the powder room.
Yes. So it really became a discussion because, you know, why would we need an extra law noting distracted driving laws when we already have it? So it was a lot of back and forth between, I would say, again, politics makes strange bedfellows. So we had some very liberal Democrats
right.
agreeing with very staunchly conservative Republicans
right.
about, you know, what does this mean for, you know, people's privacy and, you know, people's ability to live their lives. Ultimately, the bill did pass, but it's a lot of interesting debate.
Yeah. So several quick notes from me. One, the latest machination of this bill came from the Speaker. Tim Moore mm-hmm. is the one who backed this much broader proposal, which was interesting. He doesn't typically do that with bills or bills of this nature. This kind of proposal has been talked about in recent cycles, had never even gotten a committee hearing, and here we are, flies through, I believe, either four or five committees, gets voted on by the House, and now it goes over to the Senate. I'll let you respond in a second. I'm just taking off some random various and sundry here. I drove in today a 2009 Suzuki SX4, and that has no capability. This was my wife's car. She is driving the nicer of the two cars these days, but that has no ability to do anything. And then totally unrelated to that tangent is that in Virginia, when there was a hands-free, a more narrow piece of policy that was advancing through the legislature in Virginia, there was some concern from the Legislative Black Caucus about whether or not new regulations were going to allow for easier or greater levels of racial profiling on the road. So that was a consideration, not something that I've heard.
I don't think that came up here at all. There was a lot of discussion about the enforcement of the seatbelt laws here. Because originally, I think the seatbelt law was conceived as an additional tack on. Like, oh, I find you speeding. Oh, you're also not wearing your seatbelt. I'm going to charge you with that, too. But it's also become, I think, in some ways, a tool for, you know, driving while black problems and racial profiling while driving problems. So,
opportunity scholarships, hand-free devices. Those were a couple of the bigger ones this week. Let's go to the coast. You wrote about some coastal issues this week. Among them, lawmakers would like to give the shellfish industry a boost. What's this all about?
So this has been in the works for quite some time. Before Senator Bill Cook retired last session, this was really kind of his pet project, his pearl almost, we should say.
I like that.
And he was able to get it past the Senate, but it was never really taken up in the House. And so his colleague, Norm Sanderson, who's a Republican from Pamlico County, has kind of taken up this charge. And really, they just want to help boost the shellfish industry and help make it a little bit easier for the industry to grow in North Carolina, because we see a lot of the shellfish industry thriving in Virginia. We want a piece of that. And Senator Sanderson said on the floor, if we do this correctly, we can make the shellfish industry a $100 million industry a year. And so this really looks at leasing, not land, but water columns and the ocean bottoms. So it helps with some of those regulations, and it makes other rules. So it's really, it's a complicated bill to explain on a podcast and even in writing, but it's really just looking to boost the industry and to help those shellfish producers, you know, better, or to increase the industry here, because we have a lot of coastline.
Yeah.
I don't know the exact mileage, but there's a lot of places where this can make a huge impact.
Right. Well, to that point, when we're talking thousands and thousands of miles, it's, I mean, after Alaska and Louisiana and Florida and California, I mean, North Carolina has among the most miles of coastline anywhere in the country, particularly when you're talking, I mean, you have to talk about the Inner Banks. Primarily the Inner Banks for this bill, or is it all, do you know, is it all,
I forget,
ocean water again, versus
brackish? I forget offhand, just because it is such a complicated bill, and I don't want to say the wrong type of land and then have DEQ come after me.
No, one wants that. Oysters primarily?
Or? Oysters and clams.
Okay.
Which is, so I'm actually allergic to shellfish, so it's very funny. It's funny when I cover these bills, because I actually love oysters. I love raw oysters, but I can't eat them anymore. So I want to see this thrive, just because I know plenty of people who love oysters. So I like covering these bills, because it's interesting to see an industry you've partaken in a little bit, even though you can't do it now.
So I'm going to ask an ignorant question here, fully expecting some tweets or emails being like, you're a moron. Can you eat shellfish if they are cooked a certain way, or like if you take a Benadryl? Is there any way that...
So I can't... Sometimes if I take a Benadryl before, like, we go to a hibachi restaurant and I know there's going to be shrimp cooked on the same grill top, then I'm fine. But if I don't take a Benadryl, I will get sick.
All right. That's the shellfish bill. You also were following a marine fisheries piece of legislation this week.
Mm-hmm.
How closely are those two tethered?
They're tethered a little bit, because the shellfish bill deals a little bit with the Marine Fisheries Commission, which is rolled into this other bill. So I haven't been around North Carolina since 1997, but in 1997, a lot of the rules and regulations for marine fisheries in the state were written, and they really haven't been rewritten since then, and they've been done piecemeal. And there's been, I wouldn't say infighting, but there's been disagreements between the commercial fishermen and the recreational fishermen. So this bill would essentially delete the entire general statutes for marine fisheries and rewrite them and recodify them. And it would rewrite the Marine Fisheries Commission. And so it would evenly split it. So it's a 9-member commission appointed by the governor.
Mm-hmm.
So it would now be made up of 3 representatives from the commercial fishing industry, 3 from the recreational fisheries, and then 3 scientists. So Norm Sanderson, who was the champion of the shellfish bill, also did this bill. And he said they're really looking to try and bring scientific data into, you know, decision making there.
Lauren Horsch of the NC Insider here on the WNC Politics Podcast. Let's chat elections just for a moment, and then, of course, grill you on some personal things, because that's how we have to end every episode of the podcast. We had some more announcements this week. looking ahead to 2020, Tom Tillis gets a challenger, another candidate in the North Carolina Labor Secretary race. We know at least one person who's going to run for the seat that Senator McKissick presently holds. What was the most interesting 2020 news to cross your desk this week?
As you said, there's a bunch, but really the Tillis challenger, Garland Tucker, kind of came out of nowhere. And I don't know Garland Tucker. I've only been around statewide politics for, 3-4 years. He's apparently played a role before, but this is his first run for statewide office. And it's really gonna, Tillis is already hitting him pretty hard, calling him an anti-Trump activist. So it'll be, we'd been waiting for this Tillis primary challenger because the Democrats have been saying for months, Tillis is vulnerable. He could get a primary challenger. And I think we even had some, was it Mark Meadows who recently said that Tillis was open for a primary challenger or could get one. And so now we see it. I don't know how big of a contender he's going to be when he rolled out his campaign or when it was announced that he was going to run. There were a lot of snafus, like his website was basically a carbon copy of Francis DeLuca's website, and he was running for the 3rd congressional district. It even said paid for by the Francis DeLuca
His webpage looked like MySpace plagiarism or something. I mean, it was a misstep.
It was a misstep from someone behind the scenes on his campaign, and since then it's been fixed. It has been rolled out better. But even in his latest ad, he misspells Tom Tillis's name. So it's
right. And it doesn't smell like that's a purposeful elbowing or dig. It seems like, oh, that's another mistake.
Yes.
And these things,
they add
one
up.
One would think start to add up. And this is going to be one of maybe 12 or 15 U.S. Senate races where we expect a lot of money to come in. Remains to be seen how competitive it truly is. One of the things I wonder about, is you think about the full election cycle, is just how real, how contentious will this primary challenge be? And are Democrats going to be able to take advantage of it in any way? And the answer to that, at least at the moment, feels
And we don't know for the Democrats because they don't even have a candidate yet. I mean, there are three, I think, well-qualified candidates who have announced that they're interested. But I also know the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee is also out there looking for someone. So we don't know yet.
We don't. Josh Dobson, who's a member of the North Carolina House from the western part of the state, will be in what will be an open race for Labor Commissioner. Renee Elmers, I believe, is the only other Republican at this point, or is there another Republican in that race? I'm throwing you on the spot. We both should know that. I don't.
I think those are the only people right now. There's a few Democrats who have announced that they're running for Labor Commissioner. Jessica Holmes, who is a county commissioner here in Wake County, is one of them. That'll be an interesting race, an interesting primary. Cherie Berry has been in that position for a while, but she's well loved by the Republicans, but she's also very disliked by those on the left for her stances on labor positions and how workers have been treated under her tenure as labor commissioner. And a lot of people don't know her record because, they just know her as the elevator lady because her photo has been everywhere. So I don't think a lot of people even know what the labor commissioner does. So I think this will be an interesting race just from an educational standpoint. How do you get anyone to vote for you when they don't understand what you're running for?
We all have long days at work, and I would encourage people to think the next time they have a long day at work, or try to be somewhat appreciative of the fact that at least their job is not going around to the tens of thousands of elevators and changing out those pictures when that moment comes in either late 2020 or early 2021.
Yes.
That seems like it would just be a terrible job.
I actually think it would take a while.
It would take months. One person can't.
And I think it would have to be done on the inspection schedule. So it would be when someone gets their elevator reinspected.
Right.
They change it out.
But. Interesting. All right, and et cetera portion of the taping here. We're moving to the mundane and the inane. You're pretty active on Twitter. I actually looked at some numbers last night, and you've tweeted more than any other member of the Capitol Press Corps, which is unsurprising.
You can blame that on me being a digital native and millennial, because I was tweeting in high school.
You have tweeted more than half a dozen of us combined, which I do think is perhaps impressive. Is there anything that you've tweeted about 33,000 times? Is there anything you've ever tweeted out which you wish you had not, or conversely, something you regret not sending out to your Twitter followers?
Well, I've cleaned up a lot of my tweets. again, like I said, I've been tweeting since high school. At the time, I think my handle was like Lorecore, because that was my nickname in high school. And then I switched it to like something called Authentically Lauren. And then I was like, I need to be an adult. So here's my full name. You know, I don't know. I'm for the most part, a pretty open book. I tweeted a lot about my dad's battle with cancer when that happened when I was in college. I don't regret that at all, because I think people need to know what it's like to have to deal with that. I don't know if I regret anything, because I think I deleted all that.
All right.
I hope.
Well, you might have you did. There is some level of regret for tweeting it in the first place. But if you have since deleted it, I won't push you too much on.
I honestly can't remember. So, I mean, because I think before I became a journalist, I would probably tweet some political things that I shouldn't have. So I cleaned those up a long time ago.
Around here, the existence you lead is generally one of deadlines. When, presumably outside of here, is a time that you procrastinate?
Doing dishes. I have to do dishes at home because my boyfriend does not like doing dishes at all. So I think we have a sink full of dishes that I will have to take care of once I leave here today.
Leads us into the next question. You and your boyfriend, Brandt, fellow journalist, are embarking on a 17-20-hour car ride to Iowa and then to Minnesota. That begins later this afternoon, this evening.
It'll probably start around 6 or 7 o'clock tonight, and it's 16 and a half hours to Des Moines, Iowa. Oh, we'll probably make it 17 or 18 hours, because I think we'll probably stop and, you know, eat at a Waffle House or something like that. So, yes. And then it's 3.5 hours from Des Moines to my hometown.
Is your level of, I've been married for 5.5 years. Is that right? Yeah, 5.5 years almost. When we have a 1-year-old now, I don't know that I could do 17 hours in the car with anybody. My wife, that seems like that gives me a little bit of anxiety. Is your anxiety, is it just nil, or is it like climbing as you get closer?
It might be climbing a little bit, and I've been joking. As if you follow me on Twitter, you've probably seen me joke about, like, send me suggestions to listen to podcasts and save my relationship. But I've done this drive before. I did it once alone when I was about 21 or 22. And then I did it again the next year with a former roommate of mine. So it's not something I'm, you know, this isn't my first go around. So I'm pretty used to it. But I'm a little nervous because it is our first big road trip together. And we've been together for 3 years now. But we'll be fine.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Lauren Horsch of the NC Insider. Also, you can read her reporting on the News and Observer website and in the News and Observer as well. Lauren, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Glad to be here, Jeff.
May very well be a calmer week at the legislature next week. We'll talk to you again then. In the meantime, feel free to leave us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get that on-demand listening. Google Play, iTunes, and Stitcher. And if you've got a podcast suggestion, you can tweet it at Lauren, @LaurenHorsch. I'm @J_TIBS. For Lauren, I'm Jeff. Enjoy your weekend. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again soon.